Welcome all. It's good to see a good turnout today. By way of introduction, for those that don't know me, I'm Joe Hollander, the Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust that hosts these sessions in concert with the Palmerston North City Library. And I'm also grateful to the Globe Theatre for enabling us, or allowing us, to use this venue while we're still in Alert Level 2. This is Land Wars Month, even though next year we start to observe Matariki. I think it's the 24th of June next year, and add on another public holiday. But October was always seen as the Land Wars Month. And so to do that, each month now for the last couple of years, we've been commemorating the New Zealand Land Wars by having a presentation on a particular land war topic. And it's great to welcome Chris Pugsley back with us today. Chris is a bit of an expert on many of these, or one of our expert panel. And today he's going to talk about securing Wellington, or the battles for Wellington during the period 1846-1848. Look, without further ado, I'll hand you over to Chris. Chris, take it away.
Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Excellent. I've been double vaccinated, and so we're all set to go. Now, Joe, thank you very much. The best way, of course, to look at the Wellington Wars is to walk them. And I still stagger up to Battle Hill with a few pauses. And it's fascinating to see how Rangihaiata's trenches are still there and discernible. And when you add that to St. Albans Church, the Parramatta Fort at Parramatta, even though it was built after it was all over, there was a palisade and ditch in that position. And so it's a great piece of ground to have a look at. And it's interesting to see how that young Wiley Fox, Grey, mastered perhaps two of the great fighting chiefs of the period, Te Rauparaha and his nephew, Te Rangihaiata. And he does. He outthinks them. But everything, you know, there are no rules for Grey. And we will see this in the Waikato War. He is fighting Heke's war in the north, as events unfurl in Wellington. And it's interesting to see how different his approach is and will mirror what we will see when he embarks on the campaigns in Taranaki and the Waikato. One can see that having dealt with Grey once, the Maori chiefs were wise not to trust him and to count their fingers after they shook his hand. Okay, there we are. So, Page's painting, one of two paintings, of Battle Hill, and we'll come back to that. Sorry you won't be able to read the detail on that, but we're looking at the Wellington area. And, of course, nothing makes sense about the wars against the Europeans from the Wairau affray on without understanding the musket wars. And I apologise, I meant to have them out already, and sadly they're not my books, but we're very lucky in the Ron Crosby's digest of his very large The Musket Wars, The Forgotten Wars, just recently out. Absolutely superb and essential as a background to the events from the 1840s onwards. And Matthew Wright's Guns and Utu, also very good, and as I said, essential background reading. The Ngāti Toa and associated tribes had been driven south by the power of the Waikato tribes, and from his stronghold initially on Kapiti Island, dominated the south of the North Island and the top of the South Island. As Te Rapuaha said, he ate his way south, particularly in his invasion of the South Island. And so it's in that, and of course, and so the land was either depopulated or repopulated by tribes affiliated to Te Rapuaha, who too were being driven south from, in Te Rapuaha's term, from Kawhia, and then the Taranaki tribes. And of course, so with 1840, Treaty of Waitangi, it almost locked in place something that was in a state of enormous shift. And we're living with the problems that that has caused us today. And this man comes in after Fitzroy. Fitzroy, sadly, is an honest man and tries to do right by the Maori. Grey has no such qualms. He will best Te Rapuaha, and as a wily fox, an old wily fox, that's hard to do. And he will divide and weaken, he will strike alliances, he will seek court the elders of the various iwi, and then use the law or abuse the law to guarantee he gets what he wants. And of course, at the same time, telling London what he thinks London should hear rather than what actually happened. And all of this rings true for what I'll talk to. And on the other side, you've got the Ariki Toa of the Ngāti Toa, Te Rangihai Ata, and a younger Te Rapuaha, and the chiefs and the iwi that lived under their cloak. And it's important to remember that while Te Rangihiroa was a nephew of Te Rapuaha, he was a dominant chief in his own right and didn't necessarily fall into line with what his uncle wanted. And we'll see that in this talk. And the Wairau Valley, where we, 3 years after the Treaty of Waitangi, we have the first incident between an avaricious New Zealand company who, even though it hadn't bought the land, assumed it could take it. And when its surveyors went on to this, into the valley because of the problem of a crowded Nelson and not enough fertile land around Nelson for the 100-acre blocks that the New Zealand company had also sold, the Wairau was attractive, and it had been taken by conquest by Te Rapuaha and Te Rangi Hayata. And Arthur Wakefield sent his surveyors onto the land. They were politely told to go away, and no violence was used. They were sent off the land. They took their equipment, and the raupo huts that they had built were burnt. And of course, what we have then is Wakefield talking to the ex-military man Henry Thomas, the magistrate and local protector of the Maori, who raises a force of citizens, 47 strong, and determined to arrest Te Rāparaha for arson, and move back into the Wairau, where we have a situation where Te Rāparaha certainly doesn't want a fight. He just wants, he insists he's not going to sell his land. And I don't know who has seen Sally Burton's brilliant exhibition. It was at Pātaka, but it's also toured to some of the other institutes and museums. When I saw it, to me, we've got reflective paintings portraying the incident, but nothing quite captured the tension and the unconscious arrogance as Sally Burton's stick figures. You can see there you have Arthur Wakefield with a pistol stuck in his belt, Thompson with the manacles demanding that Te Rāparaha surrender to him, Te Rāparaha, Puiaha, and in the background this way, we'll see in a minute, Te Rangi Hayata, and demands, Te Rāparaha speaking reasonably while the interpreter races to translate. And there, look at the decisiveness and authority in that figure. A chief, my mana impugned by asking, demanding that I put on chains. And then, by the cooking fire, Tomorrow killed as someone starts firing from the European side. And of course, the first wife of Rangi Hayata in the background, and Te Rāparaha's daughter. And it all goes south from that point on. And when Wakefield and Thompson surrender, Rangi Hayata, having lost his wife, demands Utu, and they're killed. And of course, that stone into the pond of the New Zealand Company and the settlers in New Zealand was going to match the burning of Kororarika in 1845. You then suddenly have a realization of the threat. Up until then, there was almost an assumption that the natives will do the settlers' bidding. All that changed. And four Maori, 22 Europeans, including Wakefield and Thompson, are killed, and the settlers expect that the might of the law is on the European side. But Governor Fitzroy, who then is vilified, disabuses them because, as he said, the Englishmen were very greatly to blame, and as they brought on and began the fight, And as you were hurried into crime by their misconduct, I will not avenge their death. No utu. In future, let us dwell peaceably without... I think I've misspelled a word there. Any distrust, and I've told you my decision and my word is sacred. Well, Fitzroy suddenly finds he's very much on the way out, and he's replaced by Grey. And that promise isn't kept. And Te Rapraha and Te Rangihaiata retreat back to their base at Porirua Harbour, and they build Taupo Pa. Te Rangihaiata's pa was originally on Mana Island that you can see in the background, but they fortify as a gunfighter pa, Taupo Pa, and in fact, as the tribes gather around him, from Tom's whaling station all the way up to where Taupo Pa is, which is the present-day Plimoton fire station, back up onto that hill, are a series of fortified paths. And if you go into the Petone Settlers Museum and have a look, I don't know who built the pa, and even though it represents the pa, one of the pa, fighting pa in the hut, it's a very good model that gives you a sense of how difficult it was to break in to one of these fighting pa, but then when you got in, to actually find you're in the Hampton Court maze in trying to get to the centre with the capacity of everyone behind their series of palisades to fire at you, and they're firing from trenches and you're standing up, shows how cleverly thought out these positions were. And so that messenger drawing out of Cowan, let's put it into a context. Porirua Harbour at the bottom, the Plimoton area with what becomes Fort Parramatta and Taupo Pa with other pa near the Tom's Railway Station, the Pawatanui Inlet, and you'll see the Horikiri Valley up to the top of the top right, and the linking ridge from Belmont across through what is now Haywards, and you've got I've forgotten the name of the very good cinema there, but look up from the cinema and you will see the location of Rangihaiata's pa. And so the impact on both sides, we've seen the Maori pull back, fortify and expect utu, reciprocity from the settlers, and at the same time in Wellington it's fortified, there's a series of posts along the waterfront, and in the Hutt Valley Fort Richmond is built, and in the foreground you can see elements in their various dress of the Wellington militia. Every man from 18 to 60 is called for service within 25 miles of his local post office. And there they are, and elements of the 58th Regiment, but of course at the same time, the problem is, most of the soldiers are fighting the war in the north. And so you've got fear driving the fortification of the settler outposts and Wellington itself. And in the Valley, like in Nelson and the Wairau, you have a great dispute as to who owns what. The New Zealand company believes it's purchased the Valley. Rangiata, whose cloak the local tribes fall under, dispute that. The Atiawa around Port Nicholson have sold it, but it wasn't theirs to sell. And it's typical of the issues that are still being discussed and argued over today. And so there you have the Hutt River, and in a sense, on one side, Maori land, on the other, as far as just before Bulcott's farm, what they believe is their land, settler land, but it's disputed. And Fort Richmond is where the bridge, the Ewan Bridge, goes over the Hutt River in at Lower Hutt City. And of course, with the containment of the river, what was Fort Richmond is now in about the centre of the bridge, well underwater and long washed away. And Gray concludes satisfactorily his war in the north. He, even today, the northern tribes believe that militarily they won, and Belich is right, which is total nonsense. And he comes south, importantly, with the Navy, because the Royal Navy is key to understanding Grey's success in the Wellington Wars, but also initially with 550 soldiers under Colonel Hume, and of the 58th, 99th, and 96th regiments, as well as the Calliope, the Castor, and the paddle steamer driver. And of course, it's his ability to move, particularly with the flexibility that the driver gives him, that forces both to Rangihaiata, or initially Rangihaiata, away from the coast. And it's Te Rapraha's major mistake that he doesn't follow, as we shall see. And there's looking down on the junction, the Pararua River, the Pararua Harbour, Mana Island is to the right, and you see the Kāinga, and just at the bottom of the cliff is Taupo Pā. And Gray's first act is to establish on the 8th of April 1846 a garrison post at Parramatta, just where he can dominate all the traffic that comes into Pararua Harbour and into the Paratānui Inlet. And it's uncomfortable, winter's approaching, and 220 men are landed by sea. They dig a ditch and rampart, and then the palisades, they're in tents, and raupo huts. The food is terrible. There's grumblings, and 14 men are sent back on a charge of mutiny because they're sick of the conditions, but it achieves its end, because now he's positioned himself where, right in the centre of Te Rapraha's power base. And of course, it becomes Fort Parramatta, which is built after it's all over. However, it establishes where it was, and one can then put everything into a context when you go there today. And I'm sorry about the detail of that. It won't I don't think it can be read at the back. But at the same time, all the settler stockades marking the settlement are grey builds a military road that will mirror what we'll see in the Waikato in the 1860s. And he uses, in the main, Maori labour, and depending how much money he's got is how much activity it is, and he builds the main road through all these elements out to Porirua, and of course Tom runs the ferry across the harbour to the Parramatta barracks and the garrison. And in the same way, you can see the trails going over from Pātānui and the Pātānui Pā over the hill into the Hutt Valley. And what you've got there is Rangi Hayata's contact with the tribes who are on his side in the Hutt Valley, and he retreats from the area of Taupopa back into Pātānui because he's conscious and he fears that Grey wants to punish him for what happened at Waira. And Te Rāpraha thinks he can play both sides because he chides Rangi Hayata and promises Grey support. He's playing a clever game that in this case doesn't work. And as we see, it all goes bad in the hut, and it's the spark that sets this war alight. And you've got the abandonment. Well, the Hutt tribes are planting potatoes, selling produce to the settlers, and when Grey enforces what he believes is the sale, the correct sale, they object, and finally he agrees that they'll get monetary compensation provided they leave first. And they agree to this only for, and you'll see them leaving with the red coats in the foreground. However, as they leave, the red coats burn the pass, burn the kāianga, destroy the chapel, and rifle through the forest before they're torched. And that sparks both the tribal anger and Rangi Hayata's anger. And in the traditional way, utu is demanded. And so the settler cottages and settlements are then raided, and the settlers are forced back into safety in Wellington. And the spark of war starts. And the Ngāti Rangatahi, the Ngāti Tama, are under Rangi Hayata's protection. As I mentioned, Grey offers compensation but demands evacuation. 27th of February, illegally sends in the troops. Marainuku Pā is destroyed. Utu is demanded. 3rd of March, 1846, Grey declares martial law, and Walcott Farm, one of the northern settlements, is garrisoned by a garrison under the artist Lieutenant Page, and a garrison of 50. On the 2nd of April, Andrew Gillespie and his son, who are soaring timber on the disputed land are killed by a raiding party from Pararua. And so the garrisons are reinforced, and Whanganui tribesmen come down to support their kin. And this is a painting after Bullcock Farm has been fortified at the time of the raid. It's just a group of farm buildings with an outpost based on a tent and six sentries. And of course, it grows in the telling, the Battle of Bullcock Farm. Tapaniti Mamaku, with some 200 Maori, come over the Belmont Hill. It's a misty morning before light, creep towards the tent. The sentry sees them fired, and then it's overpowered. In the barn, which is where the principal garrison is, they wake up and start defending the barn. The women start loading the muskets for the soldiers, and outside, once Topany realizes that there's no way he could take on the barn, he is content with mutilating the soldiers in the outpost. And of course, the story of the bugle that no one hears, but because his arm is hacked off and they take it as a souvenir, everyone assumes that bugler Allen had blown it to alert the garrison. All that grows, as is the nature of Page's defence. But in fact, Te Mamaku realises that he's done all he can do. He retreats back, crosses the river. A haka, one of a number of hakas that they mount and challenge, and retires back over the hill, satisfied with events. And of course, it's one of a series of rushes where the soldiers don't do particularly well. It raises concerns that are evident already from the war in the north. And back at Taupopa, Te Rangi Haiata has moved over the hill to Pawatanui. It's interesting when you can see that view of the par itself. And at that point, Gray decides to even the odds. And he's already gained the allegiance and support of Wiramu Kingi at Waikanae. And he will now, and also the Port Nicholson Tiatiawa. And so he moves using HMS Driver to reinforce, to take Tarapa. And first of all, they consult with Kingi at Waikanae. On the morning of the 23rd of July, Ensign McKillop, later self-styled commander-in-chief of the Pararua Navy, goes ashore with a group of seamen and the soldiers and arrest Te Rāpuaha in his foray. And of course, it's said that to insist that he comes because he resists. Some talk about people, and he's striking his wife because she's obviously delayed him. Apparently she was sick, or else he wouldn't have been caught, and who knows. But the sailor was adamant. He grabbed him by the scrotum and dragged him out, and he had no choice but to come. And so he is arrested and placed on the driver with four others. And Gray has removed one of the key players from the table. And there's an image of Tarapraha during his captivity. He's held captive illegally. They say that had a writ of habeas corpus been taken to the court, Gray would have had no choice but to release him, but it never was. And so he's held prisoner for 2 years and is finally released. And part of the settlement for his release, of course, is the land and the hut, and at Porirua, the disputed land becomes part, is taken over by the settlers. And so the cost is high, and he's a diminished figure during his captivity and once he's released. And there's a lovely little sketch of Driver in Wellington Harbour with Barrett's Hotel in the background and a cargo ship there, and Her Majesty's paddle steamer Driver off Barrett's Hotel, Wellington, 1846, with Maori chiefs on board after their fight on the coast, but in fact there was no fight. And so Taupo'pa has been taken, and now the only obstacle is Rangihi Ayata himself. And at this stage, MacKillop, Admiral-in-Chief of the Porirua Navy, has a ship's cutter with a brass cannon at its front and challenging what is now a land connection to the pa that you see at the head of the inlet. This dooring is taken after it's been taken over as a barracks and as an outpost by the settlers. But it gives you a sense of how it would have looked to MacKillop, who sails up there, according to his account, has a number of narrow squeaks with the occupants of the pa, and thoroughly seems to enjoy himself. And there you see a drawing by Messenger of what it may have looked like. And so Rangihi Ayata finds himself in a situation where Puaha at Taupo'pa now sides with Gray. The Te Atiawa are siding with Gray both at Port Nicholson and at Waikanae. And he holds a cork in the bottle, which now is threatened both from the direction of the hut and from the navy in the inlet itself. And he's built a very impressive pa where St. Albans Church now stands. And what is interesting about this church is, or about this pa site, is if you look at the detail of the ground layout of the pa, when you walk up the drive towards the church today, you realize that the cemetery and the layout of the graves follow that outline almost exactly. And the hedges on the border of the cemetery roughly equate to the outer perimeter of that path. And when you look at a piece of ground, I always ask, why are the entrances there? And you'll see there's an entrance that's covered by the angles to the top of the map. You've got a side entrance slightly beyond and an entrance on the other side, but no entrance facing towards Belmont and Hutt Valley. And no entrance, obviously, on the inlet. And of course, the water has receded as a result of the 1855 earthquake. But let's have a look at it. That's us walking up the road. And you can see how the angle, and so the main entrance is in the area of the car park and the road, equating to the Partizan. Looking back, that's looking over what would have been water at the time. That's the little shopping area at Paratanui. And if you move into the cemetery itself, a sense of how it covers the inlet, and of course double palisading with rifle holes for muskets at ground level. And when you look at the approaches, you realize how carefully they've been sited with trenches connecting, communicating and connecting with each of the forests. A very difficult operation to take. And that's the view towards the Hutt Valley, and you realize that no entrance at all on that side, because that's the most vulnerable side. And that's where, in fact, the main threat emerges. Gray determines that he is going to take the Pa. It's going to be a two-pronged attack. Soldiers landing from the ships brought around to Pororua Harbour, and a second attack under Captain McDonough, the militia, the Ngatiawa, and David Scott, who's one of the principal narrators of what happens with 13 armed Wellington police. And in fact, Rangi Aiata, who should have known better, is taken totally by surprise. Some women in the pa give warning, but outside the pa, Whareautu, a Whanganui, a Whanganui chief, and I've missed out the B, brother of Topani Te Mamaku, is surprised by the Atiawa scouts. There's a tussle. He's taken prisoner and arrested. And Te Rangi Hayata, who's not in the pa at the time, realizes he's got no choice but to pull back. And the obstacle in his way is, once again, Wiramu Kingi and the Te Atiawa at Waikana. So from a position of strength, Gray has broken the bundles and captured Te Rapraha, and now is forcing the withdrawal of his one remaining enemy in that sense. And of course, he pulls back up the Harakiri Valley over the high ground. There's my grandson looking disconsolate, standing on Rangi Aiata's trenches on Battle Hill. And it's not at the top, but it's sighted, so there's no way around. You've got to take that trench. And just in the background, before that pole, just beyond that pole is a dip where the main settlement, temporary settlement, with the women and children and his warriors were. And this, with the fallen logs providing cover and the trenches that are zigzagged all along from one side of the ridge to the other, provide a stop that gives him time to get his 300 people many of them women and children, an opportunity to keep retiring. But it's winter, it's August, it is supplies are short, and they're being followed up by Puaha from Taupo Pa, Akin, but now siding with Gray, and the Te Atiawa from Port Nicholson, as well as under Major Last, a force of some 400 men, plus naval officers and naval ratings such as MacKillop. And it starts on the 3rd of August. They're pushing up the valley and they're coming across the night encampments of Te Rangi Haiata. Very difficult, thick bush. There's a patch of it just before you get to that position that gives some indication what it must be like. But no real, and only by looking at the hills to either side, you get an understanding of how difficult that going must have been. And the Paikakariki Hill Road at the bottom, you've got Last's encampment. They've been 3 days following up. You've got the encampment, and that's where the graves are today, and then climbing that position to reach Rangi Aata's trenches is captured on Page's paintings. And Maori Atiawa scouts are leading, and it's interesting that on the 6th of August, when they leave Last night encampment, Last wants silence, but Puaha's warriors immediately burst into a haka. So if the defenders up about 500 to 700 metres further up the hill have any doubts, they know they're coming. And what you see is a situation where, picture my grandson in that trench. That's where you can see the burst of firing, the smoke from the muskets just below that ridge top. And it's not the very top of the hill. As you saw in the photo, there are two or three ridges to go, a false crest to go before you get to the top. It's a point where you can hold it to allow children and women and the rest of his warriors to keep moving while he holds them. And he sighted it, so there's no way around. And of course, behind them you've got the pioneers who are clearing the way. Well, Te Rangi Haiata has already, and you get a sense of that, cleared a killing ground for his muskets. And they cross, you'll see, where a large timber has fallen, and as they move across from that, that's when they come under fire. Blackburn, the brigade major, is killed, as is another, and you've got a realization that this isn't going to be easy. They pull back, and you see a mix of military and navy, and at that point, Puaha's Ngāti Toa go to the left, and the Te Atiawa go to the right, but never push themselves to a point where they're in musket range. And that's the standoff. And all through that day, there's firing, but Last demands that the Maori attack. They quite sensibly refuse, and it's a standoff. So what happens next? MacKillop is ordered to go down and bring up two Cohorn mortars, very, and if you've seen, and I apologize for not having a photo of a Cohorn mortar there, but a very ornate brass bucket, very heavy on a solid block of wood, which they carry, they go out on the 6th, they come back on the 8th. It's positioned further back down the hill, and fire is directed towards the ridge. Nothing actually hits the trenches, but some of the fire lands in the Tamangi Ayata's encampment, which forces him to move it a bit further back. And so it's a standoff. The day before, Puaha has met with Rangihi Ayata, and David Scott, who leads the police detachment, is quite convinced that the Maori are firing blanks. And finally, on the 13th, Last realizes that his guys are doing nothing worthwhile here, and you can see the open ground, and so they pull back on the first night back into his last night's encampment where the grave is and leave it to the Maori. And then finally he pulls all the way back and leaves it to the Maori. And Gray joins him and says, well done. I don't want another Ohaiwai or Pukitutu with heavy casualties. Rangi Hayata has no choice now but to retire, which he does. He's followed up by Huaha, and it's interesting, the last action that they have at just above, on the hill just above Paikakariki, Puaha takes one fork, the Atiawa takes the other, and it's the Atiawa who are ambushed by Rangi Hayata, and I imagine that was just chance rather than any discussions that most probably were happening every night between Puaha and his uncle. Who knows? But the nature of the war means that, and of course, in 1924, an embarrassed government decides that the grave should be identified and honoured. And Whareatu, who has been the chap who was captured at Rangi Ayata's pa, is committed to court-martial without a defence counsel. He agrees that he's guilty and he's hanged 2 days later. The other Maori captured at the same time are sent to Tasmania, and a boy of 12 is sent back to his family. And of course, all of which are later concluded to be illegal, but it doesn't matter. Gray has achieved his end. He has secured and guaranteed that one with the release of Te Rapaha 2 years later, he's secured Wellington for his settlers. He's driven the borderline north of Waikanae, and Te Rapaha retreats to the Horowhenua just south of Foxton, where if you read Ray Grover's The Cork of War, he has an uncomfortable few years with diminished support and followers, but in a very strong position and will not allow any roads to be built within his area. And on that note, we could do the Whanganui Wars, but I'd have to wake you up. Thank you very much. Well done.
not often that you get a blow-by-blow account of something that happened so long ago. But thanks, Chris. That was really fantastic. A lot of history there. We've got time for one or two questions, if you have one. Don? Yeah.
I came down the Whaikok Hill the other day from the north, and I could see the transmission gully. So that road must be very close to the
it
back,
is,
back hill.
Yeah.
And maybe there should be some...
well, in fact, if you stand where my grandson was standing, you can make out to the east the transmission gully route. And so, you know, Battle Hill is sacrosanct for a number of reasons, including those sites. But the pity of it is, between when I took the original photos, when I did a series of articles for the New Zealand Defence Quarterly, they put a cart track up, and for good economic reasons, but it does mean that everyone now walks up the track without looking at the ground. They're most probably looking at their smartphones, and as they walk past, the signposts, which are there, really don't indicate where the trenches are. And most people keep walking past, assuming they're right at the top of the hill, and miss them entirely. Because as you walk past them, they're on the high ground on the right, and you have to get up on that high ground to see the zigzag. And so, you know, a lot of people go for a walk and imagine, well, it would be good to see something, and there's something there, but they miss it. But transmission gully, no problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, I didn't pick that up.
Do you think the illegal actions that Gray took justify defining him as a war criminal?
Oh, Gray. Gray did, as we see in the Waikato. If he thought he could get... You know, the problem with Gore Brown and Fitzroy is they were too obvious. Gore Brown made it quite clear that he was planning to invade the Waikato. And he got sacked for it. Gray said, no, my intention is to secure Auckland. But, you know, he built the military road south to Queen's Redoubt, crossed the Mangatawhiri in the middle of winter, which was the excuse to call in the last regiments that he needed, so that when the summer came... he could carry out the Waikato campaign, and his steamers were being prefabricated in Sydney for that summer campaign. And so Gray was, you know, in today's term, was a duplicitous bastard. But he got away with it, and when he could charm, he charmed. He collected a superb collection, which is now in the Auckland Museum. He spoke Maori, Te Whero and Te Rāpraha would have seen themselves in that young man in 1846, because he was as sneaky and tricky and as brutal as each one.
And the other question about was he a war criminal, the question you're asking is applying today's standards and legalese to what happened so long ago. Yeah. And that's the danger we can fall into in that situation.
But war criminals depends which side you're on. You know, look at...
understanding of what was okay for British
And
the rules about engagement and conflicts were established, and you can usually broke those at the time. So, in terms of the contemporary situation, I don't think we're comparing it to a modern day interpretation of a war criminal law.
But it's interesting, see, if you're fighting a white man's war against in Europe, there would be a sense of rules and fair play, even though it would be quite brutal in terms of on the battlefield. But these were wars against savages, and so the rules didn't apply. You know, as late as 1898, when's Odoman? 1898. Kitchener has all the wounded on the other side executed rather than give them medical attention.
Anyway, a good topic for another session.
Yeah, no, I was getting warmed up. Nice question. Yeah. Well done. Good question.
How did Ray
promises, land, guaranteeing land that they would their land wouldn't be taken. You know, you name it, he did it. And so,
did he keep the promises?
No, no. You know, and we see that we're a Mokini. Once it becomes clear that he could move back to Taranaki, well, that's the last thing that Gray wants, because Taranaki is open land, ripe for settlement. New Plymouth, the settlers in New Plymouth are hemmed in. He contemplates military action against Kingi, his firm ally and friend, to stop him moving back to Taranaki, because it's going to hinder his settlement plan. You know,
I can see a number looking at their watches.
Oh, sorry.
I think they've probably got to get back to work.
Yeah, no.
So, look, I think we'll call it a close there. But, Chris, once again, thank you very much for that presentation. It was most informative. And please join me again in thanking Chris. Done it again. We'll have it back, I'm sure.